The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hull. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to expert investor and stock market commentator Richard Crowe, alias Scotty Rebel. So welcome, Richard.
Morning, Paul.
Yeah, we've had lots of big news over the past couple of weeks, not least sort of South Korea and Syria and also potential stimulus out in China. But before we sort of run through your outlook for 2025, I'd just like to say a big shout out to our sponsors who helped putting the lights on today, Edison Research. I've been using them actually for about the last 25 years. They provide sort of free research for all types of investors. Let me just put their website on. So, and I strongly recommend everybody have a good look at them. But what's really interesting, I just noticed this morning is before I locked on, one of their founders actually has just written a article called UK Equities, A Generational Opportunity, which sort of like does the bullish case for UK equities for next year, how they're going to rebound. And it's all free available. So please, anybody go onto the actual website and download it. And what's also quite interesting, because it relates obviously to our discussion, it talks about the UK's been significantly undervalued and there's lots of M&A, but it also goes about selected companies. It's got Card Factory, which I know we're going to talk about later on, but I don't know do you ever use Edison at all, Richard?
I do. If there's a research note comes out on a company, I'll go there and have a read and find it always interesting.
Yeah, so I think most sensible investors do, because it's free and it's easily understandable. And it's got the forecast for companies and you can help work out sort of valuation. But anyway, that's the big shout out to our sponsor. So, Richard, in terms of your view for 2025, obviously you've had talk about 2024 and how that did first half, second half, because you had such a blockbuster start to the year. In fact, probably all the way through. But and then how you're viewing next year, next 12 months?
Yeah, well, I think I'm about 27% up for this year. And last week it's probably gone up to about 30 now. I've been keeping really track, but I went about 3 or 4% up this week, which has been pretty good. It's been a good year right up until. I did think I was going to, my aim from last October was the low point. And I thought I was going to try and double my money from October to October. It looked like it was on the cards until July got here. And that threw a nail in the real spanner in the works. And so by October, I was actually up 90%. Sorry, by July, I was up 90%. And I just decided at that point to go heavily into cash because the market looked a bit high. And it's something I do. You know, I've made great money. The market wasn't looking very good. So I was virtually sort of nearly 100% cash coming around to July, 90%, 95% cash. And I don't know, the market just didn't go down as much as I expected it to. And a few things ironed out, like Israel and the Middle East all ironed out. And, you know, the election got sorted and that went to plan and stuff all sort of went more to plan. And gradually I feel the market's got a little bit firmer and, I suppose over the past few weeks, I'm back in 90% fully invested now, you know, so it's, I think things have really started to look a lot better over the last few weeks. I was about 50% invested up until a month ago. And then, I've gradually gone back in again. Part of it is being an addict. You go all into cash. And then you sit here seeing things that are just such great bargains. And you just think, no, I can't let that go. It's just, so I totally admit, there's Alcoholics Anonymous and there's Traders Anonymous. And I've joined Traders at the moment. And that's how it is. It's like a drug and you keep finding these things. And luckily I did because, you know, I'm feeling a lot more confident at the moment over what I've seen in recent weeks to make me feel the market is on its way back up again, I think.
Yeah. Well, if you've got any invites to that addiction clinic Richard, please send them to me because I want to join the club, okay?
Circle of about 20 of us have all been doing this for the last 25 years for a living and we all go in there.
Yeah, for a quick fix, I know. So if you're 90% full, you know, invested. You're obviously pretty bullish then. I mean, obviously you want to be trading and investing in sort of stocks. Yeah. So you must be pretty bullish on the outlook. And what sort of time scales do you sort of like look, you know, sort of like to put your investment for sort of like, you know, over which sort of time area?
Well, I'm sort of, if I buy something, I'm looking to hold it for 6 months to 2 years, if possible, you know, so that's the initial plan. I might buy other stuff short-term as well, you know, I wouldn't say trading, but short-term investing, you know, three or four months, just to, when there's some news flow, I think that something's going to happen. So there'd be my sort of like timescales. Occasionally, you know, I'll take for over 2 years. But I think by the time, if you find a good investment, after many of them, after 18 months, you've had the best out of the, you know, you've had the best out of it. And I try to find something to put that money into something else then if I don't think it's going to carry on growing at that sort of pace. So, you know, timescales are very fluid with me, you know, and also I can change my mind. I'm pretty fickle. So I can see something that I think is going to be an 18-month old, and then suddenly something might happen with that, and I might decide to change my mind and use the cash more wisely somewhere else. So, you know, you don't always get these things right as well. So if I think I've pulled a bad one, then I just get rid of it and, you know, move on to something else if I realise I've made a mistake. But realise you made a mistake early. Don't sit there holding it for 2 years and decide you've made a mistake then. You know, so I prefer to, if I think I've made a mistake, that's it. You know, leave it and move on. So,
yeah. You know, Just a reminder to everybody, if you've got any questions for Richard, please put them in the chat box and I'll read them out. I've got one from Matthew. He's asking about whether you use stop losses, Richard. And if you don't use, which is what he seems to believe, why not?
I used to use stop losses. And it's sort of like in the tech boom time and everything, it was quite good. And just after that, it was pretty good. But now I think if you're going to have a stop loss, I think half these market makers know where people place their stop losses. And invariably, whenever I've had a stop loss, it seems to go just below where I've put the obvious stop. And then up it bounces. And so I think, you know, if you're on IG Index and everyone's spread betting and everyone's got a stop loss at a certain level, they can see where your stop losses are, can't they? It's sat there on their screen. They only need to drive the price down where everyone's got their stop loss. And so I start to see, you know, stop losses being it and then bounce afterwards. And then I started to think, let's put my stop loss a little bit lower so this doesn't happen to me. And then in the end, I thought to myself, well, it's 0.7 stop loss because it's that low from where I was now that you may as well just carry on riding these things. So I use a psychological stop loss on certain things. You know, if I buy something and then suddenly I see, I don't know, about a 12% fall in the stock, I obviously think I've timed it either badly wrong or there's something wrong. So I tend to come out on a stop loss at that point. So, but that's an average. It might be higher. It might be less. If you know, depending on how confident I am in the company. But I don't set a mechanical stop loss anymore. I set one psychologically on my mind. I might mark it on my chart at what point I think a share is at a point where you've got to get rid of it and do it that way and try and physically make sure that I do it. You know, you've got to be disciplined. If you're going to do it yourself, it's no good sitting there saying, oh, I'll wait another few percent and see how it goes. You know, you've got to say to yourself, that's the level you've set. It's a certain level. And be religiously in, knock yourself out at that point. And then if you've got to buy back in again later, then do so. But, you know, if you're going to use a stop loss, then make sure it works. Don't use them, you know, sort of, and then let yourself take over the job. The stop loss is there to do a job.
Yeah. Yeah, I personally don't use. It depends which pond you're fishing. I mean, I don't use stop losses because it's largely in small caps, and the liquidity doesn't justify having stop losses.
A lot of places as well, so it just don't work. Yeah. You know, the smaller you get, the less a stop loss works because the natural volatility of something that's got a 10% spread is going to be 10%. You know, so it's pretty pointless once you get down into the smaller caps. But on bigger stuff, I would.
Yeah, got another question coming in from Mark. He's asking about your latest view on Carlclo. He reckons the share price has been hijacked by some traders of late, but they're basically for investors. Carlclo is a sort of like does precision components for quite high value items, things in aerospace and optics and specialists.
Yeah, they do.
But they've got a bit of debt and a bit of a pension deficit, haven't they?
deficit yet, and they've got some debts coming down. And they make precision plastic for companies that they used to be making the test kits for COVID and stuff like that. Well, they don't actually make them. They make the manufacturing equipment for those that make them, I think. And they also make aerospace engineering pieces, which they're now targeting a lot more. So more precision parts, and instead of just, they did some pretty basic sort of parts, I think, previously, but now they're targeting new things under Frank Doornbusch, the new CEO. It's an illiquid stock. It goes all over the place. So, you know, when things are good, it's racing away like a crazy man. And then when you know, sort of traders read something, they probably trade, I think, on these results. Plenty of traders going in ahead of it, expecting, you know, oh, this will be great. We'll have a great time. Then when they get less than they expect, they all sell. The shares go down. And then once it's gone down, it makes a base. Then people buy back again. It's volatile, and that's what it is. And you know, it's something you just got to live with. It's, you know, I think they were down at about 5p back in, what was it, November? Where, how long ago was it? Probably back in, might have been May, June. I can't remember. But then they've gone up, you know, about sixfold since. So you're going to give some back at some point. You know, when people have made that much money and they suddenly become less confident, they're going to see some results. But, you know, the pension deficit is big, but I've heard them say that the triennial comes up in March. And one of the brokers, I can't remember which broker it was saying that, I think it was Pam Muir, was saying that they thought that could reduce, the deficit could reduce quite substantially there. And their target was 47p for, you know, if the pension deficit was to fall that much. They had these results, and I think their target went up to 47p without even that deficit being done. So I thought the results were pretty good. They made a profit instead of a loss, and positive earnings rather than negative earnings last year. And they look on course to at least meet and probably beat expectations. The broker forecast going forward are quite. You know, steep as far as growth goes. But, you know, all these small caps have got an element of risk, and the pension deficit is one of them, which is a bit of a drain. And will that keep going down? And, you know, what do they do with that? And the debt is pretty high, but, you know, I think they wiped about 4 million off of it this time. So it's, you know, not insurmountable, I don't think. Others might think differently, but, you know, I've waited quite a long time. One thing that echoed in my head recently was Frank Doornbusch, the CEO, said, you know, this company's overpromised and over-delivered for so long. And at least he pretty much understood about over-promising and under-delivering. So I don't think he's over-promising here. They're automating a lot of their plant out abroad. And they've brought everything up, you know, up to scratch over the past 8 months. The CEO currently came in as a non-executive director, and he took over from Nick Sanders, who brought him in. Him and Eric Hutchins are the two guys running it now, who were both brought in by Nick Sanders as non-execs. Sanders left a few years ago, a couple of years ago, and now these two are running it, and they've done a good job since they've been in there. And I think they probably will continue to keep doing a good job. But obviously, you go through like 6 months between news periods, and your mind can play havoc with you all that time. Oh, what's going on here? So it's waiting that 6 months. You don't get a lot of news in between from companies like this. But they do a presentation on Investor Meet Company frequently when they have the results, and it's good to watch that as well. You see the whites of their eyes, and I think Doornbusch looks like a guy who knows what he's doing. And when I ever said that, I thought Nick Sanders was a guy who knew what he was doing. He came from Alchemy. He was John Moulton's sidekick at Alchemy, and he came in with all sorts of credentials, and he didn't do much of a job. So you can never rely on it. But watching these two, I think they got in as non-executive directors, and they obviously thought they could do a better job than Nick Sanders anyway, and they have been doing. So at the moment, they've not let me down. So I think they're probably still going to have a good time. But having said all of that, you know, sort of if the market's changing now, so if something comes along really sort of steamy, then probably I might take a bit of cash out of there and buy something that is, you know, really looks good. I've made quite good money in there. I've banked a bit of profit, and that'd be one place if it's going to be slow compared to something else I can see, then I always tend to, you know, want to find the fastest stuff. And Yeah. And so, you know, I might trim a little bit from there if I had to, but at the moment it looks fine. So for me, anyway. No, but
yeah, no, I would agree. I think you need to look at it on a sum of the parts sort of valuation. I mean, I would say, because I've been tracking this business for ages, the core business, stripping out the debt and stripping out the pension deficit, should be able, in my view, to generate at least high single-digit EBIT margins, if not, say, 10%, because it's good, high-quality stuff. On that basis, then they're doing about 120 million a turnover. I would roughly value the enterprise value at about 130 million, i.e. one time sales. You deduct the pension, let's just say conservatively is 70 to come out, so that leaves 60. You take 15 to 20 off on the debt, let's say again conservatively 20, that leaves 50 million market cap compared to a current market cap of just 22. So you could, if because of the geared volatility, you could still see, because the equity is such a small portion of your enterprise value, you could still double your money on that if he can do the turnaround and get that attractive valuation back. So,
I think you said you're targeting 40% operating margins or something. So, I think that's what he's targeting. So, if they get to there, that'd be pretty juicy, I think. So,
yeah, no, that'll be okay. That'll blow through my value. Yeah, you're right. You could see, you could still see a multiple bagger on it because of the volatility of the gearing. Okay.
Yeah, but you have to live with these. You know, like it's all these small cap, and luckily it's fully listed. It's not an AIM small cap, so I always have a bit more confidence in a fully listed small cap than an AIM one. I feel that they long term they tend to do a little bit. They're more reliable than AIM stock small caps, but there's less of them as well. So, you know, they're more likely to, more of them will pay dividends as well. A lot more, you know, fully listed small caps will pay dividends than AIM. But so on AIM, I think you've got to rake through quite a lot of other stuff to find the good ones on AIM. But your limited choice in the small cap and fledgling sector means that there's less choice, but what's there tends to be a little bit more reliable, I think.
Yeah, no, so, very good. Very good point. Anyway, it'd be remiss of me not to ask you, given you are a guru in all things recovery, to ask you about the one of the fund managers, Lion Trust Asset Management, which has been effectively battered for the last 2 years, like all of the active fund managers. And I think it's got a dividend yield closing on 15% at the moment. What sort of like piqued your interest here, other than just being probably the most hated company on the stock market at the moment, even though it's extremely profitable and an excellent income stock?
Yeah, well, I've watched it for the last couple of years since the market's been weak. And it's remarkable how these things turn around. As soon as they start getting inflows, then, how these things turn around. And paying that 15% dividend all the time has been a fantastic return for people who just hold on, even though the share price hasn't done great for them. You know, they've been compensated by a bit of the yield. But now, you know, I see the directors, just the last interims, the directors, both CEO and CFO, bought, I think it was 200 or 400,000 pounds worth of shares each. I can't remember what the total amount was, but it was 100,000. I think the CEO had about 100,000 and the CFO had 60,000. So they're a good chunky buys. And they sounded confident. I watched the interview on Investor Meet Company, and the CEO said, you know, we're capable, we've paid the interim dividend, that's paid, and we're capable of maintaining the dividend for at least another 18 months. And I sort of think, well, there must be a term within the next 18 months. And the directors, the CEO and the CFO have just bought whacking great buyers there. It just looks it's got to happen soon. And the market does feel like it's changing to me now. You know, I'm there watching. In actual fact, I've done a couple of charts on from a Substack later, and AIM 100 has just started to break out of the resistance line on the AIM 100. And the AIM index itself is just testing the resistance on there. It probably might have even broke through it this morning. I don't know. So I'm seeing good signs there. In America, you're seeing the Russell 2000, that's the chart on that has curved up. So that's their small caps. So I sort of wonder, is money starting to flow from the FANGs into the, you know, the small caps now at this point? And also there's an interesting point. You know, people have been on about AI for so long. You know, over the last couple of years, it's become the number one feature out on, you know, NVIDIA and everything else. But how long till small companies that are actually using this AI start to say that we're doing, you know, we're doing quite well out of this. I've noticed a couple of companies recently have said they've initiated new software and it's proving to be, you know, really helpful to them. And I wonder whether we're going to see a point where both the onshoring that these small companies have done, because in their first year when you're doing the onshoring, you've got all the costs of bringing all the stuff back to the UK and setting it all up and everything else. So you've got a lot of built-in costs at that point. When we get to the point sort of like, you know, now or a little bit going forward, that all these costs are then built in and now you're starting to benefit from the income that you're making onshore where you brought business back to this country. And also with AI, you know, they've been investing in, lots of these companies have been investing in AI. And will we start to see these companies reporting the returns of that soon? You know, so I'm wondering on both those counts. Small caps would probably be the first to sort of, they're more, I think small caps are more go-getter. AI comes along and they're going to be the ones who embrace it quicker than the great big lumbering giants of this world. And so, you know, I think probably small caps is next year's story, probably, with those sort of things in mind. And, you know, that's what they are, aren't they? They're just a small cap fund managers that making money for their clients. And the second it turns and things start going the right way, then everybody's going to be pumping their money back into them. You know, once they get a taste for shares again, which is what happens, it's all cyclical. You know, at the moment, everybody hates shares, which is a fantastic time to be buying. And, you know, everyone will love them probably in 2 years' time when they're making money and shares are going up. I remember going into a pub with a mate once and he said to me, oh, he said, not very good time for shares, is it? So I said, what do you mean? So he says, they're going down. So I said, well, when do you like buying shares then? You know, so he said, you know, I said, well, it's always a good time for shares. If they're low, you buy them. If they're high, you sell them. And, but most, the average guy, you know, good time for shares is when they're up. They're really high, you know, and they're buzzing. And that's when they want to buy. So I think a year's time, if things are turned, you know, these could, a 15% yield, this could double in no time. If people are confident in the business doing well, you know, that will double and the yield will go to 7%. And, you know, you've doubled your capital and basically still your original investment is still getting your 15% yield. So they will be, some of these funds are going to be cracking returns when they do, and they reckon they can maintain the divvy. And if they can maintain it for 18 months, then I don't think the divvy's at risk, really. And if it isn't, then it will be the one that everyone wants to steam into, I hope. So I'm basically bought on that. You know, I don't know much about fund managing these funds and how they make all their money and what they do. It's all a bit, you know, sort of out of my pay grade. But all I know is when markets turn, these are the things to jump on, because you get a double whammy. You get the trading below asset value, and also you get the rise as well. And, well, it's just all geared to the upside from here for them if the market turns up.
Yeah, so, I think, to be perfectly honest, actually, Richard, you've been a bit modest there, because you could teach these guys a shed load given your returns and your performance over the last 25 years. You should be running a flipping fund manager, where you are, effectively.
I've been doing it for 25 years as a living. If I don't know what I'm doing now, I should give up and do something else. But, you know, after 25 years of doing it and you've made a living at it, you feel certain things. Do you know what I mean? It's like... Yeah. You almost, in the market almost becomes you. You look at the market and you can't say what it is, but you just know the market feels weak. And another time you can feel when a market's turning over or when a market's turning up. Just lately, something's just feeling a little bit different. That first feeling you get when you tentatively go back in again because you think things are just changing. And then 2 or 3 months later, you say, why didn't I go in with the bloody house and the farm and everything? Because you knew that was the bottom, but you're always too nervous. On this instance, I think I've done it enough times now to be able to sort of like come out quite heavy when I do come out and go in really heavy and quick when I do go in. So I've gone in heavy at this point where I think people are, you know, in a few weeks' time, get Christmas over and, you know, things might be different.
Yeah, I think we've both had the same shot of adrenaline, actually, Richie, because I have exactly the same view. I'm almost sort of like think I'm desperate for like the next 12 months to fast forward. I'd love to have the Christmas now of 2025, because I think it's going to be a great time for small caps. And your selection of Lion Trust is a really high beta play on, as I say, small caps and active fund managers, but also there's a lot of consolidation in the industry. So it could get taken out at any time as well.
by the time they're going to get to these fans are going to get taken out, it's when they just turn, isn't it? You know, no one wants to take them out while the money's going down. Once the money's going up, and that's the prime point, like with any business, if you can catch them just as they're on the turn, and investors, most general investors are not interested, they just want some money and that's it. That's the time to catch them. So I'm sure there'll be lots of M&A coming along at the right time.
Yeah. Another one that you sort of like are interested in is Sabre Insurance. We never really look at it, actually, but it's a sort of like I think it's a UK sort of motor and motorcycle insurer, et cetera. Can you take us through what sort of interesting, because it's obviously quite a competitive sector, but you have got Direct Line getting bought out by Aviva just of late. But can you take us through the investment thesis here?
Interesting that. Well, mainly I saw the bowl on the chart. If you look at the chart, it's a nice bowl. And you see right at the end here, it's just a nice little curve of you follow those little lows at the bottom of the chart. Nice little curve on that. And they're paying about a 7 or 8% yield. And I watched the presentation, and they're starting to do motorcycle insurance now. Is one of the things that they're moving into. But basically, the guys in there, you know, they seem to be doing quite well. They're having good business. They're targeting 10% CAGR for the next, I don't know, to 2030 or something. So, and that's what they're expecting to do. And I think for an insurance company paying that sort of yield, I don't normally do insurance companies, to be frank. They're, you know, so they're usually a bit slow for me. But at this point in time, with that sort of yield, and as the market's turning and... you know, I noticed there's another little one. Someone pointed out to me, Helios Underwriting.
Yeah.
Just gone, but that's just taken off like a shot. And Michael Spencer's in there, you know, the Tory treasurer, big investor. He's just been in and bought a big chunk of them as well. And that they said that, you know, the market they've got is firm. So, and I just think it's probably a sector now that's oversold, you know, with some of these yields on there, a yield like that of 7 or 8, whatever it is, nearly 7 or 8%. I think they're probably going to go higher. So it just happened to be, you know, one of the ones that I just thought, yeah, the chart's right. Directors bought as well. Just recently, there was a director buy. I watched the presentation. They were quite confident. Got a trading update at the beginning of the year. So I think maybe maybe they'll be a little bit ahead when we get to the next trading statement, and don't like them go a lot lower from here. So I ain't had a massive amount in them because it's not my normal thing. But just I've got a taste for these big yields after buying Line Trust. And so then you look around, and when market bottoms, and you've got big yields. You know, these big yields are the things that a lot of people go and track down because you know they ain't going to stay there for long, and you're getting that, and you're getting growth in your share as well. So a lot of recovery plays. Big yields at the bottom of a market is pretty good for a lot of investors. Yeah.
Well, we all know car insurance premiums have been going through the roof, so their combined ratios must be.
I understand as well, you know, I understand what they're underwriting, you know, cars, and they're going to move into motorbikes, which they said isn't well covered for people. So, and that was going to be another little thing that we're moving into. So, very basic, easy to understand car insurance. There's not much more. Yeah. You know, you use it yourself. You know it works. Okay, you smack your car, you ring them up, and they say they're not going to pay out. And that's a lot of what it is. So, you know, I think they're probably places to be.
Yeah. I think their core business, their insurance business, has got firm pricing. And if the Aviva Direct Line deal goes through, then that takes out one competitor from the industry. So, you know, that should help sort of price discipline. The only side which might struggle a bit with the declining interest rates is their investment side, because they'll be earning less money on their premiums. from the bond yields, you know, when they put them into gilts, etc. But I actually don't think interest rates are coming down massively anyway. Well, the market doesn't. It's about 4%, so it won't make huge difference, I wouldn't have thought.
No, and I don't think. I've never thought interest rates are going to go as low as everybody thinks they're going to go. I just don't think that was not a normal time, and we're back now getting towards where normality is, where we might get a small cut or two, especially after today's GDP data from 1% fall. I think it's Rachel, you said you was going to get the economy going. Market says,
Well said.
So they're going to have to, she's going to have to get her backside in gear and start trying to grow this economy, I think. And if they're not, if they're, you know, I don't think this, this government will last out as long as they think it will last out if they don't get growth. So,
no, you could be right. Okay, we've got a question. We've got a question coming from Michael Evans. He's asking about last thoughts on, I know you've talked about it before, on Capita, which is an outsourcing business. I know Richard Staveley likes this one. He's had a big position in the past, and it's sort of like, hasn't really done a great deal after making a big disposal, didn't it? Which has cleared its balance sheet debt out. How are you seeing this in an environment that the government, I guess, is absolutely battering third party type sort of suppliers, contractors?
It's a big lumbering thing, isn't it? And it's got all sort of bits to it that they could sell off, and they could put some value in there. I think that's what Richard Staveley was saying, and I sort of listened to him and thought he made a good case for Capita. Yeah. But like, you know, I think when we've had the market, what we've had over recently, a lot of traders have sold off anything again, and it's probably at a point where it's going to take another leg up, like most stocks probably. But I think there probably is the value in there. You know, I can't see. He seemed to think there's loads of parts that could be sold for a lot more than they're worth. So some of the parts play really. I think it's probably, you know, I bought a few just because I thought that if he's right, he's like Johnny Golden Balls at the moment when he was like Phil Troyan. Yeah, you know, the ones he's been picking.
Yeah, he is.
I thought it'd be unwise not to have a small few and follow him on that one, because he seemed to know quite a bit about the company, and he invests a bit like I invest, looking at these companies that have done it before and they can get back to where they were, recovery place. So I think, it's probably one of those, but I don't know whether it's going to be. I think he's probably going to move on a bit of news on a disposal or something like that. It's going to be worth.
Yeah.
The guy there is going to flog something that's going to be go for a lot more than what the book value of it is, and then people have started to get excited. But there hasn't been an awful lot of news since. I would say I'm bundlingly excited by it, but I bought a few just to have them, and I traded back out, and I might trade back in again soon. But it's, like I say, Richard Staveley, you can't ignore him at the moment, so... Mm.
Yeah, I think you need to look at it certainly in detail, but top level, given that at least half the business is supplying services, contracted services into the government, you know, public sector, etc. You've got to say, okay, if you're on the bull side, you say the government needs a lot of help and therefore it needs experts to take on more third party. If you look on the downside, you say, well, actually they're going to knock 10 bells out of a lot of outsourcing companies and insource a lot of the business now to what they think is to effectively nationalize them. Hey, and it comes down to what your view is the Labour government is going to do on those public services. So, I think you can be either a bull or a bear on it, really.
You can. When it's conglomerates like this, you know, I don't think it's going to be one of those ones that just suddenly takes off, really, because you're going to be selling bits. You're not going to be offloading one great big chunk and it suddenly becomes... of, you know, a vastly undervalued business to everybody. It's going to be bits and pieces gradually. So you'll probably get these sudden bits of news and spikes up in the price if it goes the right way. And then you'll wait another few months. It's how patient you are and how fast these deals come through. So I don't think it's a rapid game, but if Richard Stave is right, there's a lot of hidden value in there and the sum of the parts. So that would be more reason to hold it. But I say, if the market gets better, then there's probably better things than that. To, you know, there's some little crackers hanging about out there that wouldn't be bought first.
Okay, right. Well, that's a good segue into our next one. Audio Boom. The shares have just absolutely rocketed. Forget about this bowl, Richard. This one has just gone sort of like Force 9 vertical. It's a bit like a SpaceX rocket. What's happening here?
Well, in actual fact, I've followed Audio Boom since it hit that peak at, what is it, 20-odd quid. And, you know, since before that, I bought a few on the way up and I probably nibbled a few on the way down and got out again as the pain sort of like gradually sort of took hold, and you could see that there was no change in the chart at all. And I knew they'd got these legacy contracts from COVID. They went and entered a lot of contracts that were, you know, absolutely nailing them to the ground and cost them a fortune because they
wanted... These are podcaster contracts they bought.
Yeah, they do... the infrastructure for podcasting. They get their money from advertising and and stuff like that. So they did those. I didn't know, in actual fact, I watched your program last week with Lawrence Hulse, is it? And he mentioned that their contracts all end at the end of December. These are onerous contracts. So once they're out of the way, you know, next year should be, and they've already started seeing benefits by the looks of things from what they're, you know, the way they keep up in. They've had two trading updates in the last month. I bought after the first trading update. I went back and had a look. And I bought them when your Lawrence Hulse was on there a couple of weeks ago. And that was the point I bought, because he mentioned on there that the contracts all end in January, which I wasn't aware of. And once I heard that, I thought, oh, it's time to start buying a few of these then. And the chart had already just started to make a little bit of a turn. The guy in there is a guy in there, the chairman, Michael Tobin, and he's a billionaire chairman. He actually has a great video on YouTube. He's worth watching. This guy's a character. He grew up in the East End, and he's saying that, you know, he thinks sort of adversity is what got him to where he is. You know, a lot of people who do well in business and stuff have had a tough start. He grew up in the East End. His dad was a villain, ended up in prison quite a few times. He got a few brothers and sisters, and he ended up being taken out to Rhodesia by his mum to get away from his dad. So he went out to Rhodesia while there was a civil war going on. He had his house firebombed four times. Two times the house burnt down. Twice it didn't. He got shot through the leg, and it went straight in and out, straight out the other side. This is as a kid, and then he came back to London, did an apprenticeship, and he's made his way through. And all the way through it, he just claims it was luck. I was lucky. I was at this place at this time. When you actually listen to him, he's a guy who comes across as very genuine. You know, come across as very genuine and quite altruistic. And, you know, now he's working for a charity and stuff. And I think, you know, he definitely knows what he's doing. He's been averaging down for about 2 years. He's been buying every fortnight. He's been buying about 10 or 20 grand's worth of shares. And I think he probably had about 4% at the top. Now he's got 5% on the way down. And now, you know, he's getting his return on the way back up. But he's shown great confidence in to keep buying. And they started to get low on cash. But from what they were saying now, I think the cash is starting to come in. They're not going to need a fundraising. If they don't need a fundraising, then the cash starts to roll in. And they seem to be, as the trading statements come out, they're upping it by about 10%. They up their guidance by about 10%. In the last quarter, I think the last quarter must have been massive from what they said. They've made about 2 million EBITDA in the last quarter. So that guides well for next year. When you look at the forecast for next year, if they've done 2 million in a quarter this year, then what could they do next year? It's possibly a lot higher than what the current forecast is showing. They've got another trading statement. They normally have a trading update in January. So I presume they'll have their year-end trading update in January as well. They said at least in their last trading update to the upgrade. So it's probably going to be a bit more in January, I hope, as well. And then, you know, when brokers reconfigure the sums, this is something that could grow quite quick. So I mean, where it is now, you know, the way it's come down, is it was that's 24 quid, isn't it? So down to £3.50 now from 24 quid. Yeah. It's got a lot of, you know, scope to go back. It probably, you know, may not go back to 24 quid, might only go back to 12 quid. I don't know, but from £3.50, that looks pretty good. And I think people are ignoring it at the moment because they've all got fed up. They've watched it fall so far, like everybody does. There's still going to be people in here who want to sell out on the first little rise. You know, they've had enough, sell out on a bit of strength. But, they're the opportunities there. If you've got a stock that's recovering, is to buy when all these punters just want out at the moment. And we're still at that level or just around all things. So,
What's their USP compared to sort of like Spotify or iTunes, you know, in terms of the big ones? In these things tend to be a winner-takes-all market.
Yeah, I don't know. They've done, you know, they seem to be, whatever they've got together out there, they do much far better than any all the numbers when they do these reviews and how well they're doing out in America. They're doing better than anyone else, it seems, you know, every time I see a review. So they're obviously doing something right and know what they're doing. And So that's why I've always thought that they've got the chance again once the contract's ended. So they'll start making real proper profits again, and then they can reinvest that money. As I say, who knows? You know, you're dealing with companies on AIM, and you can never be 100% sure on anything. But
yeah,
from what they say and the way the business that they're doing out there, I'm going by the reviews that they get, it's pretty stunning, really. So and at the end of the day, I think if they're another target for a bigger team out there to come in and take them over. So
I think they don't have subscriptions, which might be their USP, for just because it's podcast, not music.
Their money comes from advertising, I think.
Yeah, and therefore it's a sort of like an affordable podcast service. Well, it's free, basically. All right, good. We've got a question coming in from Carco. He's asking about what your thoughts are on Warpaint Cosmetics, particularly buying Brand Architects, and how you see that. Is that a value accretive deal, or is it something that is a difficult one? It's a head-scratcher.
I think it's probably a really good deal. I think they've probably got a lot of complimentary products there, you know, that Warpaint can use, and it's a good entry. And I think Warpaint is starting to camp on the door of what is it, Elf, and it Eyes Lips Face, the American type of company that is a bigger version of Warpaint, really. And I think they were not doing as great in their last trading update, but Warpaint coming over there is probably going to be like rolling your tank out on their lawn. And do they come and take Warpaint over, or does Warpaint compete? But old Bazzani in Warpaint really seems to know what he's doing. They've had a fantastic compound growth rate. He was saying they're doing 20% this year in the US still. Things look pretty good. And I was wondering with Crichton's, because one thing that worry me, well, I won't say it worried me, but it made me think, Crichton's are doing a lot more. They call them dupes. They're like, which is what Warpaint do, duplicates of big brand products.
Yeah, but they're private label, you mean?
Yeah, they're private label for things like Tesco and Asda or whatever, and Marks and Spencer's. Dupes for them, so that, you know, that I'm sure these big companies want to, if they see Warpaint doing dupes and making big money at it, then Tesco's probably going to want a slice of the action and stuff like that. But Warpaint do it well, and they keep their costs low. And I don't know how cheap Tesco's can sell them at if they're having to put the stuff out to someone like Crichton's and somebody else's manufacturing. I think Warpaint's beauty is they get all the stuff made directly for them. Tesco's would have to reorganise it so that they're doing all that, and you've got to then the formulation and everything else. Tesco's can obviously do it. They've got the money to do it. Do they want to go in big, or do they just want to jump in on a bit of fashion for a short time? But I think Warpaint has got some real steam behind it, and the recent placing and the oversubscribed, I think it was quite well, and they seem to have it didn't go. It was only a small discount to what the price was that all the fundraising was done. So. I think there's a lot in the city that have bought into it as well. So, I think it's, great chart. It's just we got to that point in July and everybody got a bit nervous, and so the market gets sold off a little bit. And then, people suddenly get their confidence back. The market's getting a little bit better now, and people will probably start buying back in again for the next trading statement, maybe. I don't know, but that's what I've done anyway. Sort of, I've topped up recently just after the news on there, because I thought that was quite a nice acquisition for them and gives them a springboard into the US more.
Yeah, no, I'd love to actually interview Sam Bazzani, the founder and the CEO, because just explain what he likes about the Brand Architects, their particular brands, because it's W7 and Technique brands, isn't it? Have just been stormers across the world. So trying to, if they can get anywhere near repeating that and converting one of Brand Architects' brands into something like that. Because I think Brand Architects, they're only buying it for about, is it 15 million quid or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. It's not massive money. It's small money, So, I think it could be good.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I think it's a no-lose situation, because even if they don't make a success of it, it's compared to their market cap of 400 million, it's peanuts, isn't it? It's optionality money, actually.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem a guy that, you know, goes and does daft things, bizarrely. You know, every time you see an interview with him, he says, we've got no debt. He says, we don't even owe money on the photocopier, you know, and sort of, we even own the photocopier. So you sort of think, yeah, you know, he gets it across and he's quite interesting. They both kept big stakes in, you know, although they both, the shareholder, one of the shareholders sold a load of shares recently. You know, they've got to sell shares at some point. You know, the shares have gone up, blooming how many fold, I don't know. And at some point, you want to have a bit of the money and enjoy it. And, you know, so, but they didn't go and try and lump the lot away and sell the whole lot. So that's comforting as well. So, yeah, I think one director did buy a few, small shares recently. So, yeah.
Well, let's move to Creighton, because you actually did mention it. They're basically They do beauty products. They've got some of their own brands. They make also contracts for other brands. And they also provide private label products to the big supermarkets, etc. What sort of piqued your interest here? It's a sort of like a, I think it's a 23 million market cap business.
Yeah, another one I followed for when Johnson, the old boy, Bernard Johnson, joined the company years ago, probably 15 years ago. And I watched it from then, and he sort of like, he did a great job. They kept ticking up, making a nice steady progress. Weren't setting any houses alight or anything like that, but they're making, you know, good progress over the years and good returns. And then a couple of years ago, he just seemed to go bananas, and they bought two big brands. They, you know, so it was almost like his swan song. He was getting a bit old, and he wanted to, and he came on, I think PI World or Investment Mix Company or something, and said, oh, we're going to get to, you know, massive bloody turnover in no time, and we're going to do this, that, and the other. And I thought to myself, it's unlike him. You know, they bought this Emma Hardy for $15 million or something like that, and weighed out a load of money, and they've had to write it down straight away. But, you know, they've been making the stuff for the guy who does Emma Hardy, so they knew they were actually making the stuff for him, and this company was like putting it up and selling it, so they could take it in house. And it was just daft. They bought another brand as well, and they overspent anyway. Long and short of it was, they'd overstretched themselves. Shares plummeted. They've had to write down somebody, Emma Hardy, and what they've bought. And he's left, and the other McElroy's, the chairman, they've both left. And now Pippa Clark's running it. And in all honesty, she's been over the past since she's been the sidekick of Bernard Johnson, she seems to have been running it more or less for the past 4 or 5 years anyway. And when she speaks and you watch the presentation, now she knows it clearly inside and out. You know, if you watch the presentation, he'd have gone over to her and said to her, what about this? So you could see that she seemed to be the knowledge there at the business. Anyway, what they've done is they've cut back their factory. And they've reduced they were running a day and night shift. They've ended the night shift. So they're only running one shift now. They reduced their factory footprint. They bought Emma Hardy in-house. And they've really sort of leaned up the business. And I think they were saying that they took one of their production lines so much. So they took one of their production lines, broke it all up, and made like another production line out of it where this old one wasn't any good, and just did it themselves to put another production line together and save money. And like she was saying, it's surprising how much you can do with such little space. When you try, you know, it's like everything, you know, you got a space that big, you fill it, and they had too much space, and they managed to shrink it all down. So they've cut their costs amazingly, and the last set of results, they came in ahead of forecast by about 10%. They've reinstated the dividend, and the only fly in the ointment at the moment is they're going to pick up about 400,000 to 600,000 in costs from what Rachel Reeves did with the National Insurance and the minimum wage, which was an unexpected, but they seem to have the momentum to ride that and probably come out the other side, still even doing better than expected, I think. So, you know, I like them as a small company. They do private label for the likes of Tesco's, Marks and Spencer's. They do white label for, you know, like other businesses, like they make contract manufacturing, for, you know, businesses that make products, but they have to put it outsourced the product to other people, and these other businesses just sell them under their brand. And they've also got a few that they sell under their own brand themselves. So it's three legs to the business, tour are a bit weak at the moment. The private label is doing stuff to like Marks and Spencer's and Tesco's is doing well. And that's really picked up. So I think they, you know, the way they've spoke about what they're doing in private label, that seems to be where the margins are, and they're doing well and they're focusing on that at the moment. So hopefully, yeah, if you get the other two brands growing, the two divisions growing as well, then there's gains to be had there. But she's definitely got the, you know, got the costs under control. And the fact they pay the dividend as well at the end of the last results was quite a positive, I thought. So and they just look cheap. So small, very difficult to trade. You buy more than, say, 20,000 of the things, and the price ticks up where you have to pay a premium unless you find a time when there's some shares about. But, you know, sort of, so I would shed loads of them because they can be difficult to move. But you know, I like it as a company.
And it's only on 11 times PE. So, I'm with you. I've got a quick question.
Quite a bit of property assets as well. So, all in all, they're not loaded up with a load of debt or anything.
Yeah. We've got a quick question, which I can answer, actually. It's from Paul Cooper. He's asking about Finsetta coming off recent highs. This is basically a payments company, small market cap. It's run by a guy, actually, that used to work at Equals, which we all know has been this perennial company stuck in a 13-month strategic review, got bought out. Now, Equals, just to let people know, was bought out on 11 times EBITDA multiple historical. I'm not 100% sure, so I'd have to check with Finsetta. But this company is effectively a smaller replica of Equals. It's an IT, you know, sort of platform, straight through processing, international payments business that is growing at around about, I think it's growing about 40-50% per annum for, you know, top line at least. So, but from a smaller base. And I think it trades currently at roughly around about, I don't know, 7 or 8 times EBITDA, but that's historical numbers, and it's growing significantly. So all I would say is that on this one, watch its trading update in January or February, because it could get another leg up, particularly with this sort of consolidation in the area. But hey, I haven't actually spoken to the business recently, but they certainly had a lot of momentum in it. Okay, good. I'll just take that one down. We've got another one to move on to. Let's go for one of your plenty of it. You've been all over this one, Card Factory, because I know I've had this one for a lot. It's basically a vertically manufactured greetings card. But interestingly, which was quite surprising for me, was they've just bought somebody, really quite a transformational deal in the States as well.
Yeah, Card Factory. I've followed for since COVID. They got absolutely hammered in COVID, and they had the COVID loans. They brought in a guy, Darcy Wilson-Reimer. I think he's one of the most sharpest CEOs, retail CEOs in going. I think he was at Cost Cutters for so long. He did a great job there, and they brought him in. They paid down debt during COVID. It's got massive cash generation, this business. Absolutely huge. So they're paying debt down even during COVID. With the cash generation, he's brought the debt right way down. They were doing fantastic. They, for a long while, they had Telios in there, which was a company, a fund that bought in shares. They bought about nearly 20%. And no sooner had they bought them, it looked like they had cold feet, and they started selling them again. And they were just dumping shares into the market, which crashed the price for months. It just couldn't get above £1 a share at the time. Eventually, they sold out. As soon as it did, the shares took off. And UBS, just before the last set of results, UBS come out with a price target of 180 pence. Said, you know, all the time I've held these shares for a couple of years, on and off for a couple of years, UBS has been the most boring, downing sort of broker you could have. And they've never been optimistic. Suddenly, they come out with this 180 pence target a couple of days before the interims. So I think everybody got excited. That very big spike right at the top there went from 125 to 145. So 20 pence in no time was partly by the last 2 days of it was UBS's price target. So everyone excited. The interims come out. The company had already said that the earnings were going to be weighted to the second half. So that was sort of known. But they come out and the interims were so different to all the previous interims, where it was like, you know, the cash flow, the profit, everything was sort of like far more negative than you'd ever seen from them. And I think people just panicked at that point and thought, hello, you know, they've had the cost of the new minimum wage from the government last year stuck through, and the Tory government put through, which absolutely walloped them for God knows what. And everyone just sort of like panicked and sold it off. So I sat there thinking, well, it's not that bad, really. You know, the shares might come off 10 pence today. And I sat there and it opened down 20 odd pence. And I thought, well, that's a real, you know, sort of over the top reaction. And it just kept overreacting all the way down. And it weren't until it got down to about, I think, probably 115 pence, 120 pence before I thought to myself, oh, blow this, I'll sell some shares as well. So I sold a bunch there, hung on to a small few. It got down to a pound where I thought it would probably bottom. Mm. And it didn't even bottom at a pound. It carried on going down. Friends were saying to me, I think 90 pence will be the bottom. And I just sat and watched because the chart was just going down, making a big curved sort of bottom. And I've just been waiting for it to make that final bottom piece, which it did at about 80 pence. I watched it just, wanted to see it just like looking like it was going to turn up. And it got to about 85, at which point I bought back in again. And then a couple of days later, they said they bought this company, Sinven or something, is it? What's it called?
Yeah, I can't remember what it, yeah. It's a US one, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Small US company, car factory distributor of gifts and manufacturing distributor of gifts and cards. And it gives them a nice leg into the US. You know, they've been expanding all over the world, card factory. They're out in Australia. They've got a Bridget Kitchen Shop out in Australia. They've started taking over a business in South Africa. They've got, they're in the Middle East. They've got a franchise out in the Middle East. But going into America, you know, they've sort of parked their tanks on America's lawn again here with them, because the big ones out of there was American Greetings, which owned the shares in Clinton Cards over here. And they've been struggling. You know, they are struggling. So, but card is vertically integrated, print your own cards. The margins are, you do a lot. You design the cards, you print the cards, you deliver them, distribute them, you sell them at a full retail price from your shops. Then they also do wholesale. They've just doubled up with Aldi. They were doing 500 stores for Aldi, supplying them cards in 500 stores. Now they've got the exclusive deal and they've doubled up the number of stores to 1,000. All this stuff's got to kick in. So when the results first half and the cash flow and everything was really much lower than expected, they had said they were going to do that, you know, because they'd spent so much money building up stock for the likes of Aldi and other businesses. And the money comes in the second half of the year when you get Christmas and all the rest of it. And because with this acquisition they made, they put a trading statement in there and they said, we're trading in line with expectations. Well, expectations have never been reduced, even from that high, you know, 180. So the expectations are still the same that they're going to do, I forget what it is now, say like 14 pence EPS this year.
Yeah.
If they do 14 pence EPS, well, they're just over a pound, they're on a PE of about 7.
Yeah, and, that's right.
And, you know, probably 6 going forward, because there'll be growth going forward as well. They've started paying a dividend. And then the finance director's just come out and bought 20,000, and the Wilson Reimer's just bought 50,000 shares straight after that trading update. And they're just there, their Christmas period. And they said, oh, you know, we don't know what the Christmas period's like yet, but trading's good and in line with expectations. If they're in line, they're going to do the 14p they're always originally going to do. And the share price has just had a mad one and come down again. What will people do when they come out with a set of results that are in line? You know, you're going to look at that and think, blimey, you know, what was the sell-off all about? Mm-hmm. So I do think that it's one of the best-run companies in the country. They've got fantastic cash flow. The guy running it's good. He brought in his own CEO, Matthias Sager, who came from Cost Cutters as well. So he knew him well. And just watching the presentation when they did it, their presentation from the interims, you know, Matthias Sagers, the CFO, almost looks, I would say, smug. He got sort of like that look on his face that I know something you don't know, because you've all gone, you know, like you've all gone mad and sold the shares or whatever. But, you know, things are going as we say. So I just get the feeling that things were all going right there. Punters just had a huge, great mad panic because they saw the way the interims looked. And it was just one of those times when the market was weak anyway, and everyone was expecting retail to be weak. They read these results and just thought, well, that's it then, you know, like retail's finished. And it was just like sell everything, you know, and all retail's saying, but I've noticed lately a lot of retailers, you know, are doing better than they expected, you know, Currys yesterday. Yeah. You know, their results were better than I would have thought. Currys, of all people, you know, well, I watched the bowl on there and Alex Baldock take over. And he's always promised stuff, but he hasn't really done it. But suddenly, in this climate, Currys are delivering. And then watching the Switzerland said, you know, things are going pretty decent. And so I'm trying to think who the others are on retail. You know, Crichton's are selling into retail, so they were doing all right. But, you know, what banks doing?
Well,
all right.
I think Next and M&S are down to do okay at a Christmas.
They just do stuff right. They go on doing well no matter what happens. The state they're in next. And Marks and Spencer's is getting to that way as well. So, you know, and there's I think Fraser's is probably one that's taken a bit of a wallop in that. But even Kingfisher, they were sounding sort of a bit more upbeat as well. So you sort of think, you know, it's all in the price here. You know, retail is probably all in the price here, I think. You know, can they, you know, get any worse than where they are? So that's why I like buying them, when everybody's sort of like, you know, writing retail off, you know, it's finished. And then suddenly everybody says, well, I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
And the expansion in the US, you know, that could be, you know, they're going to get their sales car factory. And the more they sell, because they're manufacturing themselves, you know, and if they can sell themselves at the end of the chain, their margins are far higher than you are if you're going out to distributors and you're going out to someone to design. And Clinton Cards is sort of like finished, I think, because they buy all their cards in there. It's costing them about 40% more than it costs car factory to get the cars into the stores. Well, you know, if you're 40% down to start with, you haven't got a lot of hope, really. And trying to keep up and modernise your store chain, and I think they're just going to keep gradually dying off store by store, drip by drip.
And I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, they make 15% EBIT margin, so clearly their model is very good. And they have got pricing power, even though you'd think cards haven't. But they to make 15% margins, they do. I would highlight to investors actually, if you want to actually get a bit more information, it's on the Edison website, etc. You can pick up their research note, which I haven't done myself, but I'll just load it up. What have we got? This is their latest one. So you can actually delivering on partnership growth strategy there. So written by a guy called Russell Poynton. So please have a look at that if you're interested in a bit more information. We've got a follow-up from in the same sort of section.
Say before that, I was going to say, what they actually do with the cards as well, like putting up prices and stuff, they enhance the cards as well. He was saying we don't just put the prices up. They actually sort of like say if a card goes from £1 to £1.20, that card will have been enhanced some way. So it'll probably have more glittery on the front or it'll have a bit of extra verse on the side, or they might have a little bit that they'll clip into it. So that, as well as putting up prices, they enhance the value of the card that they're pricing as well. So someone doesn't walk in the shop and think that's the same card. It's gone up £1.20. It's a better card. So in a way, they're not putting up prices due to inflation as much as a lot of other businesses just have to, because they can't enhance the product.
No, it certainly looks cheap, paying about 5% dividend yield. We've got a question on similar sector, actually, which I know you've liked before, is Shoe Zone from Truce. And he's basically saying what your latest thoughts here are.
I don't know what happened between the brothers, actually. I've heard there's a bust-up or something, probably, between the brothers. And one of the brothers has walked, you know, I think they're volatile characters from the Smiths. They're the two brothers that run it, and they're the big shareholders with more than 50%. And I just don't know what went on there that I think one of them's thrown his toys out of the pram and something went wrong and the other one's taken over. So I sort of, I like the business. I like the business. I like them running it, but I don't know what's going on between them. So whether there's, you know, disagreement or something like that going on there. And the only other thing is Temu, whether shoes being sent in direct from China. I don't know, do people want to buy shoes from China? What's the sending back of shoes at China? You know, it's bad enough if you've got to send stuff back to Amazon. I don't know whether I want to guess my size from China, because China's feet are always smaller than... I'll buy a jacket from China and I order it, and I'm a fairly sort of slim guy. And, you know, so I'll order in a 3XL jumper because I want it to fit me. And when it gets here, it's like a 1XL, or it's not even like a, it's just like an XL or a medium. And I say to Karen, oh, God, I'm going to have to send this back now, or I'll don't bother. I will throw it down here, and we'll, I won't even bother sending it back. I'll give it to one of the nephews. I order about four times size greater than what I need in order to get something to fit me from China. I've given up, actually, so I did it a couple of times. It's a waste of time. So what are shoes like? You can't sort of do with your jumpers, you might get away with being a bit tight. You can't get away with shoes that are a bit tight. So trying to buy shoes online from China, I think, is a no-no. You're going to be sending them back, or you're going to keep a pair of shoes that's too small. You're going to be buying them too big for you to look like Coco the Clown. So it's, I don't think that's a worry for Card Factory. Shoezone. I think that's, you know, and they've got good stores. They park their stores right next to places like Marks and Spencers and stuff like that, so they get good footfall. And, you know, the brothers do know what they're doing, but I would just like to hear what's going on there between them, because I think there's a bit of a spat I wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
And it did fall pretty quick, and they haven't sounded so upbeat, perhaps, as they were. Yeah. So, I'm sure they've got plenty of customers going in to buy shoes, but it's just, what's the business behind the scenes like?
Yeah. Well, just on, we've got a comment coming in, just referring to your lean frame there, Richard. David Hapsball's asking, he's still waiting to see your Mankini, Rich. So I don't know what you mean.
He'll be the only one who's waiting to see it, to be honest. If I'm totally true, every time I've mentioned it, don't show me your Mankini.
Okay, well, and then moving on in the same area, we've got a bit of pump in the iron. We've got the gym group that has sort of piqued your interest as well. Low-cost gym provider in the UK. Actually, my daughters use it, and I would say it's because it's the cheapest and you can get in any time, I think. But how are you seeing it anyway? The shares have done remarkably well, actually.
Yeah, they've held up really well. When you look at the chart, that's gone well, actually. And they go have these pulses where they go up for a bit and then they just come off. But the general trend upwards is good. What they were saying is, they are the cheapest, and their business model is different because you can just go in there and pay for time. You're not tied to any contract, and I think people like that. And also, you can go in there around the clock. It's one of these no frills type of things. I don't think you've got the saunas and all the, you know, other bits and pieces that come with some of these other gyms, but the model is definitely liked. And I looked at the chart, I looked at the trend, and I think growth wise, they're going to do quite well. So it's a really easy model to understand, you know, just a better gym model than the others that all insist on these contracts, and they're eating into them. I think they're eating into the sector. And you know, like they give round the clock 24-hour. I think a lot of these stores are round the clock 24-hour. You can go in there and do a bit of gym in the middle of the night. So shift workers and stuff like that probably find that, you know, going in there at 3 o'clock in the morning before they go off to their work shift might suit them as well. So, yeah, and the chart just looks good. And I think there might have been a little bit of director buying there as well a little while back, but I can't remember offhand whether they have. But it's a nice business. And the last presentation, I watched the presentation that they did or listened to it, and it all sounded like they were confident of seeing momentum. They were seeing momentum at the moment. And like everything, everyone's got a trading update in January just after Christmas. That's the time when all these things are going to reveal themselves. I think a lot of these businesses, everyone's so depressed. You know, the government is making a hash of the economy, and you know, all these businesses are having added costs on that they weren't expecting. And everyone thinks it's the end of the world. And I think a lot of these retailers and the like are passing the prices on. They're not going to sit there and take the government lumping a 5% cost onto them, and they're not going to pass it on. And they've had to tell the government that, you know, we're going to pass it on. Otherwise, they're going to get these 5% extra increases every year and expect retail to, you know, bear the cost of it. And I think Marks and Spencers and a lot of others stood up and said, no, you know, we're going to be passing these costs on that you put us. Mm-hmm. And that's given that, you know, and Rachel Reeves sniffing around there trying to find cost cutting, you know, and doing a bit of austerity now. And now they know they're not going to be able to pass the the prices straight onto retailers and just keep pushing it through and make them absorb it. So good move. I think all these businesses that have done that has taught a lesson. And I think people can see now that next year there's not going to be a load of costs waiting onto retailers, and that was probably priced in. Yeah. And we'll get the NHS National Insurance one this year and the higher minimum wage. But from then on, they're going to have to, you know, the government's going to have to be steady about what they pass on to retailers, because it's just going to knacker their inflation policy if they think they can get away with it and retailers are going to put prices up. So, yeah.
I think you're spot on that somebody like the Gym Group, because it's a sort of no-frills operator, it's got plenty of scope to push prices up because it's still hugely cheaper than... I'm a member of a local council sort of swimming pool gym, and that's over 40 quid a month, which is about another 30% higher than the local one at for Gym Group. And David Lloyd is at about 120 or 100 pound a month. So, you know, Gym Group can easily absorb the extra cost and push prices up to cover it. In fact, they'll probably do it even more because the other guys were forced to put it up even higher.
Well, they were saying in this presentation that they can put their prices up still. They're still regarded as the best quality. They get some good reviews as well. When you go on Trustpilot and have a look, the reviews on there are good. And they were saying that they've got the space to put their prices up still.
Yeah, it's what the shares have been saying. Another one which has been in the sun of late is On the Beach. And I know you like this one. This is obviously overseas holidays. I guess the clue is in the name. It's all beach holidays, whether it's winter sun or summer sun. But what sort of piqued your interest here? It's the shares have really taken off, haven't they, just recently?
They've got new directors. They've had a new board for a couple of years, and they've talked the talk. But one of the things they've had a dispute with Ryanair for quite a while, and that all ended recently amicably, and now they're going to be they've done a deal with Ryanair, and they're going to be providing holidays out in Ireland as well. With that ended, and they sound really upbeat, and the results come in well in line, and you're looking now I think about 18 pence earnings for the coming year. So where are they now?
20, I think yeah you about, are yeah 18p yeah
you're about you're about 13. Well, yeah. 18p EPS is nearly at the height of their record. 21 pence is the most they've ever done, I think. There's a little bit of dilution in the shares there, but the old high at 21 pence a share would be around about £4.20, somewhere around there, if they didn't have that dilution. And now they're doing 18 pence. And I think myself, they've got about 90 million in cash, is it, I think, which is free cash, not tied up by... Yes, they've started doing 25 million in share buybacks. So the share buybacks are probably going to add another 0.5% to the EPS, by the dilute EPS by the time it's done. And there's a trading update in there. Let me just see what... Oh, remind me what they said on the...
I think they're talking about strong winter sun bookings, and they're starting to fill up their summer bookings as well for next year.
And they're doing really well. But the real little cracker in there in the results was they put on their what they're targeting, and they're targeting total transaction value of £2.5 billion, EBITDA of £100 million, and adjusted pre-tax profit of £85 million, all in the medium term. So they get back to that, they're probably going to be doing 40 pence a share earnings at least. And if they do 40 pence a share earnings, these have been, in the past, these have traded on PE of like around 20 odd. You're getting up for 20 in the past. You're doing 40 pence earnings per share, you stick that on a PE of 15, it's £6. And they just look so cheap compared to where they've been in the past and what people have, you know, gone after. So trading statement in early in the new year, and they sound upbeat, and I think people will be buying that for the trading statement at least well before them, because they took off. They've gone up about 40% in no time. Shows how things turn around. You know, I stuck these in my stock challenge, UK stock challenge that Typo runs on the internet for the year last year. And I On the Beach and Watches of Switzerland. and they both absolutely caned me at the start of the year. And I was out of about 440 people, I think I was 380th. And then in the last month or two, that's completely turned around. I think I'm running about 20th position now from 380th, because those two just turned. How things turn around after a year, or how things change, you know, in that sort of time. So, you know, that's one that's just absolutely, I've always thought they were good. They needed a new board, and the new board got in there, and I thought they were doing it, but it was all a bit slow. But now there's some momentum building up in there now. So I've bought a really big position in those, because I think they're probably going.
Yeah, well, it highlights a very important principle for all investors: patience equals profits. And you've got to wait. Yeah. If you've got your investment thesis, then things can sell off for a variety of different reasons. But I would say the whole sector for package holidays is very strong, because I think Jet2's holiday part is doing well. You've Optui had a very strong performance. EasyJet's also holidays. And I think what's happening is that people on sort of lower to middle incomes are migrating to all-in-one type of holidays where they get guaranteed sun, but they know the sort of the top cap cost of it. And they've got obviously positive real incomes as well in terms of their wage increases at the lower end, in sort of minimum wage, and also, you know, sort of like the public sector pay deals and stuff like that. And so consequently, I think it's going to be a very strong area for the next 12, 18 months, actually.
Well, it's the whole trick. Yeah, the whole trouble. So if you look at IAG, the airline, I've never seen so many upgrades for that. You look at that chart's turned up in the last 6 months. I've never seen so many upgrades. There must have been 10 upgrades recently. Like £4 at the upgrade. The last upgrades are like £4 plus. They're currently at £2.90, and this all started down at about £2.20 odd. The chart is just curving upwards like a plane taking off, really. So, but you've also got Jet2. You know, the upgrades are coming to them. They beat expectations recently, and their chart's just broken to a new high. You look at Carnival as well, the cruisers.
Yeah,
that's another one that's just taken off, and they're saying trading's good. I do think people, when we had COVID, everybody sort of had these massive bout of holidays and really enjoyed themselves. And then I think over the past year, and we had Ukraine and everything, people, you know, pulled their reins in a little bit and said, you know, we can't keep doing all of this like that all the time. But I think having taken it a bit on their chin last year on holidays, I think this year they're all back in force, because, you know, the last year hasn't been as good as when they had the COVID holidays, and, you know, they were doing all that, and people are appreciating their time more. What they say, life's short, you've got to stop to look around and enjoy it now and again. So I think people find leisure is a much more important thing in their priorities than it used to be, you know, where it's work, work, work. People don't go to work now. They stay at home, and they've all retired early, or they're on benefits, or they're doing something, and for 3 day weeks and everything else. I don't know what's keeping this country running, to be honest.
Not me and you, mate. We're 24/7.
Yes, and who's going to make the money? And that's all we do. So I'm moaning about all these people don't work, and I don't feel I'll do a proper job either. You know, people do prioritise their free time and their leisure a lot more now than I think they were doing. So it's a second.
I think the two differences with IAG, obviously British Airways and Carnival, is the continental exposure, particularly at the Atlantic, because the Americans, given where their stock market, their net wealth has just soared over the last two or three years, you know, the S&P 500. And that's given that's sort of like worked through the wealth effect through their economy. And where those people who own stocks and shares have done well, they're spending it liberally. And you're seeing that in transatlantic flights, that the prices of the fares are huge. And likewise with the cruises, all the cruises coming out of the States are just solid. And if you got that crazy situation where you had a boat in Northern Ireland that had been docked for 9 months, and it was full of Americans who just could party for 9 months on board because they had enough money. I mean, it's just like, just shows you the difference in the economy.
Oh, no, it's happening over here as well. So I took so many people who are going on a cruise now, you know, so Karen's sister, she went on a cruise about a year ago. And she said, oh, it's a big boat, one of these big boats, you know, and they didn't like it because it was massive. And she said, oh, it's all too big. And you know, they're here then, yeah, and then she said, oh, cruise is not for me. And they just said to me, oh, we're going on a 4-day cruise around Belgium and here, there, and everywhere. And just they're off tomorrow. So, you know, a little winter cruise, and they're just, it's just like a big party boat, really. You're not going to get off going around Belgium and stuff like that. I can't imagine that's a fantastic cruise to get off of and go around. You know, stay on the boat. Stay on the boat, free food, free drink, just stay on the boat. So that's probably what I should think they'll do. And it's like a 4-day booze up before, you know, Christmas comes. You know,
don't say that around Brussels. You'll get mobbed there, Richard. Okay, yeah. Now we've got a question. Grant is pretty keen for you to say a few words on U Group, which I think is a challenger energy business that supplies sort of energy into the business community. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever looked at this. The shares really took off about 12 months ago. Strengthened again. I don't know if you've ever really had a look at this one.
I looked at it right at the lows there when it was just after, what price was it down at? I think it's probably down at about £8 somewhere down there. It might have been even lower than that when I looked at it. And the bit where it took off right there, so it's down about, I think it's down below £10 when I first looked. And because the way that charged and the results have been fabulous there and everything, but I didn't understand the business. You know, they're telling me they're making all this money and you're going through this bit where, you know, energy prices weren't the right price and they're probably going to come off and then, you know. So I didn't understand if that was going to keep on going once the price of energy started to come back down again. Mm. And they've obviously got something about them because the price has stayed up and they've carried on doing well. So, I like it. I missed it and I'm bitter. But, you know, sort of. And it probably is a good company. I need to research it more. And I just don't know how long that advantage they've got will last. So that's why I've never really bought into it. Even, you know, I had a little quick trade, I think, for a little short bit. But, you know, I would have liked to put that out on if I'd been confident.
Yeah, I think what the bears miss often is that because we had that huge spike in energy off the back of the Ukraine-Russian war, that meant that a lot of challenger energy providers, these virtual energy providers, went bust. And we saw that. And then the government had to step in and pay for that. So the competition, because it's been wiped out, has reduced significantly. So there is price discipline now in the market between the bigger challengers like you and the big four. But equally, the government is not now giving the licenses out to be an energy provider, which they were before. They were handed them out like Smarties and confetti previously. Mm. But now they're not going to give any new licenses out. So actually what we've got is an oligopoly between the big four and the efficient challengers. And I think this is actually a long-term winner on the basis of that. And therefore you do have a really quite a strong defensible moat. But I don't own it. But I would say I think the bears, in terms of have they got a competitive advantage, haven't really looked at the dynamics of the market on this one. And I'm with you. I've missed it.
Yeah, I never really was bearish on it. You know, it always looked interesting. And, you know, there was, I think, the directors got shares and stuff like that in it. So it always looks, I never really turned bearish. I just didn't have an understanding enough of it to be able to say that it was going to outperform when these energy prices came back down again. So that's why I sort of ignored it to a great extent, much to my my annoyance.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're coming towards the end. We've got a final one, which could be the bowl of the century here, is Focusrite. And it's basically a high premium audio visual sort of equipment provider, largely into professional markets, but also into sort of like, you know, people who really want to have high performance audio at their own home, etc. Did really well, obviously, when lockdowns in the pandemic has got a bit more competition now, and some of the demand has quietened off. But the shares have stabilized the last month or so. In fact, started to go up.
Yeah, Carol, the guy who's running, is an American guy, and they're not a million miles away from me, and they make Scarlet, which is like the one of their products is Scarlet, which is like the tuners and amp type things. Mm. It doors for people and musicians at home and on stage. And they've also gone into a lot more into audio equipment now as well. And one of the they've acquired several companies, And it, over the course of time, China has been their bugbear because getting stuff out of China, and so much stock was built up before by their businesses that they supply during COVID. They built up huge inventories and they've been working their way down and working their way down. Well, they're beginning to sound like these inventories are starting to wind their way down now. And the one thing they have done, which has helped, is where if you sell particular electronic products and there's a huge amount floating around in the market and you can't, and they're not selling, you can't sell no more of your own product back out into the market. You've got a bloody logjam there. But they've made up about 26 new products since COVID that they've been selling. And all the new products where there isn't a glut in the market are selling really well. So that's helping to increase their sales while these inventories run down. And, you know, they've battled along, they've battled through, and I think they're at a point now where they're probably, having said that, I thought a couple of times they're at a point where they've already got down to their where they should have been. And we're going to bounce, and they haven't. So as it stands now, I think they've probably got to a point where they're bottoming. They went up on results. It's the first time I think they've got up on results in a long while. You know, when the results have come out and the shares have just dived. This time the results came out and the shares firmed up. And there's been some big bits of volume go through there lately, I've noticed. And I think probably when these inventories die off, their earnings are going to start to grow quite pretty exponentially, I think. And so that's why I'm in there. They're a really interesting company that do some really top products. That's the thing. All their products get some fantastic reviews. And whether it's the audio or their audio products or their mixer products that they've got, all of them seem to get cracking reviews. So
yeah,
I think this is a great time to, you're trying to catch this bottom all the time. And they look a reasonable value. I wouldn't say they look cheap at the moment, but I think that valuation, they'll grow into that very quickly as good news comes out. I think they've got a trading update. They have another trading update in January or so, and they're quite a way well into the results come out, and they're already a quarter into this year when the results come out, 3 or 4 months into this year, when they publish their first quarter results, their first half results. So they're a long way into the second half now. And or the half that they're in, rather. So,
yeah,
I think
they're only on a PE of less than 7.5 times, so they're not expensive. And I would say if they can get into any type of aftermarket servicing, so like, you know, have recurrent revenue streams off the back of their quality products, a bit like the way Apple does its services business on its iPhone, then that's the sort of the model they need to do. It's tough to do though in electronics hardware.
Yeah, I honestly think they'll probably get. You know, I think there'll probably be a takeout. They'll get taken out by a US company of some sort, because it's a good product quality, and the PE ratio compared to what you'd pay out in the States is probably a lot different. And they'll eventually target. I wouldn't buy it just for a target. I like the products that they do. I've seen the nephew and some others have got their products, and they all rave about them. And when you watch the presentations as well, the CEO's laid back, cool, American, you know, and sort of all the things are going through. He's always got a positive there. They've kept the dividend running, and it's one of those. All at this point in the market, you've just got to have faith. You know, sometimes you can sit there and you hear stuff, and it doesn't sound fantastic, but it sounds better than it did. And if you hear that, then you've just got to have the faith to say, you know, hold on in here, because it's too late when these companies start telling you things are great. You look around and it's already one bagged, and you just sort of think, where was I then? Why wasn't I listening? Why wasn't I paying attention? And that's the secret, being in there before everybody sort of like piles in. So,
okay. Well, that naturally leads into the final question then, which is going to be the top performer next year out of all those stocks we've discussed, or even another one. What's the stock that you think is the most exciting idea for next year there, in 2025, Rich?
I think On the Beach is probably, that's why I've bought a lot, because I think On the Beach has probably got the capacity to be, once I noticed, who was it? Is it BlackRock this week was buying a load? They're piling in to buy a load or whatever. But I think that's got the capacity to, when people look at what it's done in the past and what it's doing now, and they start weighing up where it was and actually seeing what it's got there and having a bit of belief in it. You know, at the moment, people saw the results. It sat around. It went into auction on the results, but it didn't go up nowhere near as much as I thought it was going to rise on the results. And there's that beautiful bowl on the chart, which you can't ignore. And then the fact that it's past earnings, you know, I've got it down. I believe it will probably double. It'll be a one bagger in a year. And I call them O-Buy Ace, O-B-I-A-Y, one bagger in a year. And looking for those out in the market. A few months ago, there didn't seem to be many around, but just over lately, a few sort of like poking their head above the pit, and you sort of think, oh, yeah, that could do. That could double in a year. And this is, if I had to pick one that was going to double this year, I'd probably say On the Beach. That would be, if I had to stick my neck out, you know, and you know, I've got my money in it, so.
Okay.
But well, there's probably a few, man. It's probably quite a few sat out there, you know, sort of.
Yeah. Well, when we do our next video, then we'll coincide it with you doing some product testing of On the Beach out and getting some winter sun somewhere with your mankini on, and we can then hit sort of like multiple objectives in one go.
Don't even go there mentioning me and my mankini, and at the same time as On the Beach. It's not going to do it's not going to do their credibility a lot of good. So
anyway, I'd like to say a couple of things. Big thanks, obviously, to our sponsor again, Edison, for putting the show on. Really grateful for that. And I would strongly suggest investors have a look at their research. I do. Look at their, actually, that forecast was magnificent in terms of small caps and UK equities for 2025. And if you want more detail, obviously, on the Card Factory stuff, then that's there as well. But again, Big thanks to Richard for your comments today. Happy Christmas, and I hope you have a great new year as well. So thanks again, Rich.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who watches and everyone who goes on the Substack. It's great to talk to people, and I enjoy it. So Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to everybody. And if it's a prosperous one, it's all the better. But as long as it's healthy and happy.
Best of luck with all investing. Thanks, guys.
Lovely. Cheers. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.